Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, and I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Giesel, Senator Ellis, Senator Stevens, and I'm Senator Costello. I'd like to thank the Recording Secretary Carrie and the LIO Operator Donna. Without your help, this meeting is not possible. The time is 1:30. Five bills on today's calendar. House Bill 26, the Board of Direct Entry Midwives by Representative Olson. House Bill 116, which extends the Alcohol Beverage Control Board by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. House Bill 178, Workers' Compensation Study by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. House Bill 46, the Veterans Seat on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board by Representative Sadler. House Bill 41, the Sport Fishing Services by Representatives Tilton and Mignoz, and we will not be hearing Senate Bill 107 today. With that, I want to welcome Representative Kurt Olson's staff, Laura Steidel, and we will hear the bill today. We will take members' questions, we will take public testimony, and then close it, and I will look to the will of the committee. So welcome, Ms. Steidel, and please feel free to introduce yourself for the record and explain the bill before us.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Steidolf, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is HB 26. This legislation extends the termination date for the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives to June 30th, 2017. Each year, the Division of Legislative Audit reviews state boards and commissions to determine if they should be reestablished per AS 2444. The Division of Legislative Audit reviewed the activities of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether there is a demonstrated public need for the board's continued existence and whether it has been operating in an effective manner.
Excuse me, and I'd like to welcome Senate President Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. As the members noted in their review of the audit in their packets, it is the opinion of the Division of Legislative Audit that the board be extended 2 years to June 30, 2017. You'll see in the opinion of our auditors, the board is serving the public interest by effectively licensing certified direct entry midwives and apprentices. Additionally, it was found that the board continues to improve the profession by modifying and adopting midwifery regulations. As the members also may have noted from the audit, there were four findings and recommendations, including having the department pursue disciplinary cases, increasing licensing fees to eliminate the board's operating deficit, having the board communicate certificate requirements to continuing education providers, as well as approving apprentice applications in accordance with statutes. To speak to the recommendations, Chris Curtis of Legislative Audit is here, as well as Director Janie Hovedin of the Department of Commerce. Cheryl Korick, the CDM board chair, is online from Anchorage. In closing, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives serves an important role in protecting the well-being of Alaskans by identifying individuals who are willing to pursue technical training and meet specified technical qualifications necessary for licensure as midwives. The continuation of this board is very important for the health and safety of Alaska's women and children. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, and I'd also like to invite Chris Curtis up to the table and to review the audit, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor. Our agency did conduct an audit of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. Purpose was to determine whether the board was serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. Overall, we concluded that the board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing certified direct entry midwives. Although the board is operating in the public's interest, we found that Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, DCBPL staff, failed to operate in the public's interest by not pursuing timely disciplinary sanctions related to four midwife investigations. Because of the serious deficiency, we recommend the board's termination date be extended only 2 years to June 30th, 2017. The audit made a total of four recommendations. The first and most significant recommendation was made to the Department of Community and Economic Development's commissioner to take immediate action to pursue disciplinary sanctions for midwife cases when warranted. The audit found that disciplinary sanctions were not actively pursued for four investigations which were completed during the audit period. The investigations involving two people concluded that disciplinary sanctions were needed
However, DCBPL investigative staff did not actively pursue sanctions to protect the public safety. In all four cases, respondents refused to sign a consent agreement. Rather than file an accusation and pursue an administrative hearing, DCBPL staff followed alternate procedures. Two of the four cases were forwarded to the Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecution and Appeals, OSPA, without a sufficiency of evidence review by an Assistant Attorney General. The audit found that those two cases remained at OSPA for over a year without action. According to OSPA, the cases represent their lowest priority, as the cases are Class B misdemeanors. The other two cases were held by DCBPL investigators with the understanding that the cases would be forwarded to OSPA once the other two cases were resolved. Due to staff turnover, we could not determine why DCBPL staff did not follow or pursue civil licensing action as required by their standard operating procedures. At a minimum, licensing action should be pursued concurrently with criminal action to ensure the public is protected from incompetent, negligent, or unlicensed practitioners. By not pursuing licensing action, the respondents were allowed to continue to practice and the public safety was placed at risk. The audit makes three more recommendations for operational improvements. We recommended that DCBPL, in consultation with the board, increase licensing fees to eliminate the board's operating deficit. Occupational fees did not cover the cost of regulating the board, and as of March 2014, the board had an operating deficit of approximately $115,000. We recommend that the board communicate certificate requirements to continuing education providers to facilitate compliance with centralized licensing statutes or regulations. And we recommend that the board approve apprentice permits in accordance with statutes. The audit found that permits were being approved by DCBPL staff, but statutes only allow the board to issue the permits.
Thank you. Are there committee questions for the sponsor or of Ms. Curtis? Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So help me understand this. So normally you would extend, if things were fine, for how long? What would be the length of the extension you'd be asking for?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, the maximum allowed for in statute is an 8-year extension period.
So you've recommended 2 years, which is pretty serious, obviously, and the charges are pretty serious. So what would be your intention then to come back in 2 years, and what would have to be done before you recommend another extension?
Through the chair, we would expect the next audit to be smaller in scope, given that we had just reviewed the entity 2 years earlier. We would really focus on what they've done with their investigative aspects of the board.
So it would be mainly these two issues you'd be looking at then. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Senator Kiesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess possibly more a comment, though I'm interested in Ms. Curtis's response. This concerns me a lot. I mean, the purpose for a professional regulatory board is to protect the public. And you found that 4 out of 48 licensees had some kind of question related to their license. I mean, that's 9% of their licensees, if my math is correct, 1/12. But regardless, that's pretty significant.
Through the chair, you can't be assumed that they're all licensed. This could be unlicensed activity. Investigations revolve to some extent to unlicensed activity.
Understood. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Madam Chair, follow up?
Please.
The second issue has been longstanding with this particular board, and that is their deficit. I mean, $115,000. I don't know how 48 licensees are going to make that up. Do you see a plan going forward for them, or is that something you'll leave for the division?
Through the chair, I'll leave that, the plan aspect, to the division, but I do want to say that our 2006 audit of this board identified that they had the highest fees at that point of any occupation. So this is a historical problem with the board, not just a recent problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Don't mind my following up. What are the fees that are currently a midwife would pay?
Through the chair, the fees are identified on page 15 of the audit.
In FY14, the midwife initial certification and renewal fee was $1,450, so $1,450. At the time when we did the 2006 audit, the fee was over $2,000. And that, through the chair, is the midwife initial certification fee. There are other fees for application fee and apprentice.
And if I could follow up.
Sure.
I'm sorry, this is your field and not mine, but what happens if unlicensed, somebody is practicing without a license? What is the charge? How is that dealt with?
Through the chair, unlicensed activity does fall within the preview of the division to pursue an investigation. I think the division could probably provide you more details as far as what they do in regards to unlicensed activity.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I'd like to invite Division Director Hovedem to the table. Thank you. And Sarah Chambers, you're welcome also. We have to grab another chair. And please feel free to adjust the mic. It doesn't seem to be always
great
projecting voices, so feel free to adjust that.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Janie Hovenden, the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. With me today is Sarah Chambers, the Operations Manager, who is much more informed on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Director Hovenden mentioned, I'm the Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing, Sarah Chambers. I'd be happy to answer any questions or address any of the issues that members have brought up.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you. And if you could answer the question, what happens if someone practices midwifery without a license?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, for any of our licensing programs are 43 different licensing programs, 21 of which have boards. We go through a process of investigation and discovery. We involve either a board member or a subject matter expert to review the facts, especially someone who's very familiar with that particular licensed industry. If there is determined to be sufficient cause for a violation, then we would pursue, as Senator Giesel mentioned, if there's an opportunity for a consent agreement, pursue an agreement that both parties could come to, which is the most amicable as well as the least expensive way to pursue acknowledging a violation and how that person is planning to correct it, which may include licensure, license probation, if it is a existing licensee, fines, and so forth. In many cases, unlicensed activity, someone is often not willing to go to an amicable agreement, and so we work with the Department of Law to file an accusation of violation of law, and then we'll pursue hand in hand with the Department of Law whatever sanctions are available to that licensing program within their statutory or regulatory scope. Sometimes those are more civilly punitive. Often there is a criminal misdemeanor that's attached to such practice. Most of our programs do have a misdemeanor violation attached. So we'll pursue those.
Any further questions? Ms. Chambers, I know, since I've been serving, the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licenses has had issues with boards and deficits, and we've had plans before us and assurances that it would be rectified. And what is the division's plan for addressing this situation?
Madam Chair, thank you for asking. Since the audit was initiated about a year ago, the fees for both midwives and apprentices have been increased. The board, as Chair Corrick will likely testify to, is aware of this deficit, this historical deficit. They are with us very open to the fact that they have to cover those costs, and so they have been working with us to raise all of the license fees within that program. What we've prescribed, which is within the statutory realm in which our fee setting operates, is a sort of a stair-step program to try to chip away at the debt in a reasonable manner without becoming incredibly burdensome on midwives. Their license fees are still the highest in the division. A licensed midwife now pays $1,750 for a license, and so we are working together to try to chip away at the deficit. It is very difficult, as I believe it was Senator Giesel who mentioned, with such a small number of licensees, when investigations of either licensed or unlicensed practice comes up, they have to bear that cost, and that can be a highly expensive and volatile cost, especially if we are going to the accusation and even the appeal process. So there are many challenges that are facing this board, and we're working together to try to chip away at them, as well as to do our very best to prevent, within the realm that we can, any expenses that may further exacerbate that deficit.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will ask Ms. Chambers if she could verify this, but my understanding is the reason that they fell into such a deficit is they did have a very large legal case, which cost the board a significant amount. It went through the court system. Of course, boards have to pay for that. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that predates my time with the division, but that is my understanding, that with this board and a few other of our boards who are facing large deficits, that the volatile and expensive investigation costs are what skews the whole license fee setting process at some point along the continuum, and then boards have to kind of work to dig out of that.
Senator Giesel?
Madam Chair, just a follow-up that this committee might be interested in, some of the discussion as another committee looked at this and other board deficits is the fact that boards don't get to retain the penalties that are levied against their licensees, which could help offset some of this. If a court settlement requiring a fine on that person that violated their law has to go into the general fund, so just something to think about for the future. The second thing I wanted to bring up at this point, Madam Chair, just for clarification, this is the direct entry midwives, not the certified nurse midwives. There are actually two separate licensee groups of midwives. Just wanted to clarify that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I do remember that discussion. I think there was actually legislation that addressed perhaps having the legal fees come out of a different source, but also I remember this discussion that if penalties go back to the board, then there is some sort of a motivation then to be pursuing more penalties. And so that politicizing of the board fees is certainly an issue, and I look forward to someday not having any of the boards have a deficit or have this issue, because we've been struggling with it for so long. So, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Giesel's expertise is real life. Mine is watch the midwives or whatever the show was. But, so I know it's just very, very shallow. But maybe you could help me understand. Midwives, I assume they're not all full-time jobs. I assume there are part-time midwives. Are there people who are called out upon occasion? Or can you help me understand that? I mean, $2,000 seems to be pretty high if you only are doing one case a year, for example.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, you're exactly correct. The business model of this licensing group can vary just as it can with any other licensing group. There are successful birthing centers across the state who employ multiple full-time midwives. There are also the people who are working to do this along with other pursuits. So just like someone might be a part-time construction contractor or hairdresser, it's really no different. And those differences are also very apparent depending on what the rural or urban nature of their locality.
And follow the license is absolute. If you are a midwife, you pay the fee, whether you're full-time or not.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, if there's one issue that was raised by the committee, if you wouldn't mind my addressing it briefly.
Absolutely.
The members brought up earlier concerns that Legislative Auditor Curtis mentioned, which was the just the specific cases that were found to be deficient in our administrative process. I did want the committee to know that since the audit, when we met with Auditor Curtis and her fantastic team, we have dug deeper into our investigative protocols, our quality control measures. We have a new chief investigator who is just fresh on the job when the audit came out, and we have worked together to really tighten up any of the standards, the time frames, and have also been doing that, working with Department of Law and OSPA together to use this audit as a tool for further quality improvement within all of our agencies. These specific cases, thanks to the work of our chief investigator, Angela Burt, these specific cases are fully in compliance with our stated protocols now and are working through the system appropriately as the audit would have hoped to have found initially. So I believe certainly it will be Legislative Audit's recommendation in 2 years potentially, but I believe that we are in full compliance at this point with that, but take full responsibility for our agency to continue to prove out whether we will be able to stand the test of compliance per auditing standards. So I wanted to provide that reassurance to the committee.
I like maple donuts. Just an aside. Yeah. While you're here, Ms. Chambers, could you review the fiscal note for the committee?
Yes. I can turn to it. Well, the fiscal note speaks just to the termination of the board, or the sunset of the board, and just reflects, reflects the changes that we would anticipate if the licensing program were to lose the board but continue to be one of our programs that we license. There are these expenses are specific to travel and board meeting preparation, so we would anticipate a change in those expenses because we would no longer have a board that we would need to support or change the travel. So since the sunset assumes that the board sunsets, this would reinitiate what we're currently expending for travel.
Okay. Do you have any questions from committee members? I see none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, Senator Giesel.
Madam Chair, could I ask Ms. Curtis to come back for a question?
Sure. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Curtis, you're recommending a two-year time period for sunset. Have you ever considered a shorter time frame, that is 1 year?
Through the chair, I did consider that, and I had a long talk with Sarah Chambers about that and asked them how much time will it take to address this, what is reasonable. We think 2 years would be sufficient. It sounds like they've done a even quicker job than maybe originally anticipated, but we did work together with them on the appropriate time frame.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel, do you have any desire to have an update then in a year's time? Was that your thought?
That's my thought, especially if the division is actually making some corrective steps. I think it would be helpful to have something back, even though it may not be a full audit. Do you ever do anything like that, an interim report, so to speak?
Through the chair. That direction would come from the LBNA committee, but however, we just are finishing up on an interim non-audit follow-up on RCA. They were going to be bringing a memo to the committee next time it meets in May with that informal type of follow-up on a prior recommendation to see how they're doing sort of thing. So it certainly can be done, and it has been done.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kiesel.
So is that best done through intent language in the sunset bill or an informal request to LBNA?
Through the chair, my only knowledge of it being done would be through informal requests through the LBNA. That's my only knowledge of it being done in the past.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Giesel?
Nothing further.
Okay.
Let me contemplate this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. Appreciate it. Now I'd like to open public testimony on House Bill 26. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one. Is there anyone at an LIO that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony is now closed, and I'm going to take a brief at ease. Has come back to order. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer, a conceptual amendment that would capture legislative intent that we request an interim one-year status update from the audit division on this particular board, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives.
Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is a conceptual amendment is adopted. And I will look to the will of the committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 26, version 29 LS0171/alpha as amended from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We have Senate Bill 116, which extends the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. It's the first hearing for the bill. The intent is to hear it, take members' questions, any public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee. I'd like to welcome, again, Laura Steidolf of Representative Kurt Olson's staff. And excuse me, I think this is House Bill 116, not Senate Bill 116. I apologize for that.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Steidolf, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is HB 116. This legislation extends the termination date for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to June 30th, 2018. Each year, the Division of Legislative Audit reviews boards and commissions to determine if they should be reestablished per AS 2444. The Division of Legislative Audit reviewed the activities of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether there is a demonstrated public need for the board's continued existence and whether it has been operating in an effective manner.
The board has addressed all issues found in prior audits, with two being resolved and one being partially resolved. As you may have noted from the audit, there were five findings and recommendations in the most recent audit, including having the board's director ensure that all board meetings are properly published on the state's online public notice system, notifying local governing bodies of applications for new and transfer licenses within 10 days of receipt, issuing catering permits in accordance with statutory requirements and recreational site licenses in accordance with statutory requirements, and finally, that the board should implement a process to monitor and track all complaints to ensure they are resolved in a timely manner. As you also may have noted, it is the opinion of the Division of Legislative Audit that the board be extended 3 years to June 30th, 2018. In the opinion of our auditors, the board is serving the public's best interest by effectively licensing and regulating the manufacture, barter, possession, and sale of alcoholic beverages in Alaska. It should be noted that until HB 123, Established Marijuana Control Board, is passed, regulation for marijuana falls under the ABC board per the initiative that was passed last fall. This is why the fiscal note reflects expenditures for the regulation of marijuana. However, this money was not allocated and can be removed if HB 123 is passed. To speak on this, Cynthia Franklin, the director of ABC board, is here, as well as Diane Burnham of Legislative Audit. Thank you for supporting this legislation today.
Thank you. Ms. Franklin, would you like to provide testimony?
Thank you. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Bill. Thank you for having me today. I joined the agency in September of 2014 at the tail end of the legislative audit process and was able to oversee our final responses to the audit team. I believe that we have taken care of the issues in the audit, many of which were resolved prior to my joining the agency. I am obviously in support of this bill and believe we can do the work. I believe the three-year sunset period was arrived at because the auditors did recommend that if ballot measure 2 passed and marijuana was added to our list of duties, that the sunset period be shorter in order to address what was happening in the interim. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Do you mind going through for the public listening the actual numbers in the fiscal note, please?
Certainly. The fiscal note for purposes of HB 116 is informational only in that this bill does not appropriate these funds. The information is before you so that you can see how the agency spends its funds. The fiscal note relating to the marijuana regulation is a match to the fiscal note that is attached to HB 123, creating the Marijuana Control Board. So the $1.78 million for the alcohol duties of the board is contained in the governor's budget. The governor's budget originally contained the $1.54 million for the marijuana regulation that was separated out, and it was requested by the legislature that those monies be included in the fiscal note process as marijuana bills made their way through the legislature. The $1.54 million for the marijuana regulation is reflective of a $50,000 cost for marijuana control board. The remainder is for personnel and services relating to the regulation of the new substance. There is a fairly significant expenditure in the services section for a software system that will be necessary for the regulation of marijuana. It's called seed-to-sale tracking software, and it would enable the regulatory agency to tag marijuana plants and make certain that marijuana that is sold to the public in licensed establishments is marijuana that has been grown by licensed cultivation facilities. So it enables the regulatory board to track the marijuana through the system, prevent black market marijuana from being sold in legal establishments, and make sure that the marijuana that is being sold to the public has been tested according to the regulations written by the board. Additionally, our agency is a paper-based agency, so there is some funding in the marijuana portion of the fiscal note for database so that we can report both to the legislature and the public as we move forward with marijuana regulation. We know from our visits to Colorado and our conversations with Washington that many agencies and the legislature are going to want a lot of data on marijuana, and the way that the agency is currently set up in order to provide, you know, wide swaths of information, it requires staff research, which is time and money. So the services section of the marijuana fiscal note includes not only the services related to the personnel, to vehicles for investigators, for legal services relating to the writing of the regulation, but also for those technological expenditures. Is that enough detail?
Thank you. And the number of staff that are incorporated in this, could you mention that also?
Yes, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board currently has a staff of 10 and myself. Five of those are enforcement officers, three are licensing specialists, and two are administrative personnel. In our FY15 supplemental, we added two positions to accommodate the time that we've spent since November 4th and daily since working on marijuana issues. That was one licensing specialist and one administrative personnel. The FY16 budget contains an ask for four additional personnel, one additional licensing specialist, and three additional enforcement officers. So that brings a total agency of 16 plus the director for both substances statewide, eight enforcement officers, and five licensing staff, and three administrative personnel. I think I got that right. And that is quite low compared to our counterparts in Washington and Oregon, even when you account for our lower population. We do anticipate as we move forward with licenses that we will need to beef the agency up, but we believe that this is adequate to get started, and that's really what we're looking for. If I could just say one more word, because there have been questions raised throughout the process of following the Marijuana Control Board bill through in terms of adding enforcement in the first year when we won't have any licenses in effect until May of 2016. We have already found that we've spent quite a bit of an enforcement personnel time answering questions about what you can and cannot do legally with marijuana in this state now that this ballot measure has passed. We have at least three, probably more like four or five businesses that have gotten out ahead of us and are engaging in commercialized marijuana activities without licenses, without being subject to any regulations. Relying on general law enforcement, DPS, or local law enforcement agency to enforce on and shut down those businesses in the interim while we get this operation up and running, it ends up, frankly, with spotty enforcement depending on their priority list. So we believe it is imperative to find enforcement officers early so that we can make sure that everyone waits until we have these rules in place and that we have personnel to address any business that wants to get out ahead of their competition and open for business before they're legally allowed to.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much. So is there any, now I'd like to actually open public testimony on this bill, House Bill 116. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify? Is there anyone online at an LIO who would like to testify? Seeing a head shake, no. So with that, I'll close public testimony. We do have the Title IV rewrite before us, and we have another marijuana board bill before us, so there's plenty of opportunity to, get into the weeds further on this. And I think with the urgency of extending this board that it would be prudent for us to move it out of committee today, seeing the will of the committee. Senator Meyer.
Yeah, just a question, Madam Chair. You alluded to some issues that that we and the auditors have had with the ABC board in the past, and I faintly remember some of those issues. Can you refresh our
my memory anyway, what those issues were, and you said you've corrected them, so maybe tell us how you corrected them.
Certainly. The issue number one in the audit was a public notice issue of whether or not we were publicly noticing our meetings in the correct place, and we solved that with staff training. And I personally checked the public notices for each meeting as the director of the agency. Issues two and three, I might not be going in the exact order of the audit, but there were two issues regarding licenses and permits. Catering permits were being issued to businesses that were in transition, that were perhaps having stock transfers or changing ownership, and they were using a catering permit process to cover the gap, so to speak, and that is improper according to statute. That's operating outside the statutory limits of the catering permit process. So that process has just been halted by us and by the board, and that was halted prior to my coming onto the agency. The recreational site license issue was an issue of taking that rec site license, which is outside of the population limits license, in the sense of someone coming to the board applying for a license that they could not otherwise get because the community is limited out on their alcohol licensing, and claiming to have a recreational site. Well, by statute, that is an event that has a before, it has a specific time, a before and after time. And there were a few licenses that were issued for places that, while recreational activities were occurring on premises, they weren't exactly what the statute clearly contemplated. An example is a gym in Anchorage that was issued a recreational site license. So the gym is open all the time. And when you go look at that statute, it basically says you can sell liquor 1 hour before the event and 1 hour after the event. It's clearly not what the statute contemplated. So that issue was solved by discussing with the board the limitations of the statute, and the director and the staff making sure that the board understands that they must stay within the statutory limits on those licenses. And again, and that is a problem that was essentially solved before. The board has been very careful in my meetings that I've had with the board so far to make sure that they're staying squarely within the statutory language on issuing any license. There was an issue prior to our current licensing supervisor, where the previous licensing supervisor was saving applications in batches and then sending them on to the municipalities, which caused her to miss that 10-day deadline in some cases. That was solved with the new staff person, who strictly complies with the 10-day notice requirement. And what am I missing there, the fifth issue? All right, and so because we are a paper-based agency, we are a very small agency, we're very amenable to the public calling and asking us questions, and that occurs with the entire staff throughout the course of a day. So we instituted some Excel spreadsheets, which is the most technological that we can get in our office right now, to track those complaints.
Thank you. And Senator Meyer, we do have Diane Barnaham, who is from Ledge Audit, who can actually go through it with us if you'd like
no,
that.
No, I'm good. Okay. I do have a follow-up, though, and I'm glad you corrected the notices to the assembly, because I think a lot of times they like to get input from the community councils that are impacted, and if there's only a few days before they have to take action, they're not able to do that. So glad you have that taken care of. Now, I'm going to reflect back on my days on the assembly, and it used to be we'd have complaints about a particular bar or a packaged liquor store or what have you. And then the ABC board, you make a decision if our decision was arbitrary or capricious, I think. Is that the terminology?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the local government protest process is a very important part of Title IV. So if a local government protests the license, then 411-480A says that the board shall uphold the protest unless the board finds the protest to be arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. And we have had protests since I've been on board from the city of Nome that the board upheld. So I am aware that in past days, although the board, I'm not aware of the board undoing a city protest, I am aware of a prior practice of tabling those protests, so that particularly with regard to tax debts, so that that essentially gave the licensee an opportunity to pay off the taxes without the city's protest being acted on by the board. It is not my experience that the board, as it is currently composed, has engaged in that practice. We had a protest by the city of Juneau at our February meeting, and the board upheld the protest on the spot. So I think some of those issues that you experienced, Senator Myers, have perhaps been resolved on their own with a new iteration of the board combined with the audit, the stakeholders process, and some changeovers in staff.
Madam Chair, and it's been 15 years since I was on the Assembly, so I'm sure things have gotten better, but it just seemed like the arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable is pretty subjective, and I was just wondering if there's, in your opinion, a more definite way of, you know, it just seems arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable is, you know, what may be for you is not for me, I guess.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, our new attorney in Commerce, since we moved to Commerce, we got in a new attorney in the Attorney General's office. Our boards and agencies attorney, Harriet Milks, has provided excellent advice to the board about the legal meaning of those terms, and we've made it very clear to all the local governments that have approached us about a potential protest that that is a very high standard for the board to overcome, not only because each of those words as a legal term of art essentially means the board has to find the city protested the license for an unfair reason because of the color of the licensee's hair or something such as that, but also because there's an and in there. So the board's inquiry really, in order to deny the protest or not uphold the city's protest, the board has to find that the city was arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable, and our attorney has done a good job of explaining that to the board. I recently traveled to Bethel, where there was an application for a liquor license, and gave a presentation with the blessing of our chairperson to the city of Bethel, to a town hall meeting there, that basically said your best opportunity to kill a liquor license is at the city level because the board standard of review to overcome that city protest is so high. So there is a recognition by the board at this point in time that the city's right to protest is statutorily superior to the board's opinion, and I believe that they have acted to that effect in the board meetings that I've been in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you could just address the timeline here, see if I understand this. Normally, you would be audited and receive like a six-year extension. In this case, it didn't happen because you possibly marijuana would be added to as your responsibility, so it was truncated to a three-year extension. What happens if you don't get marijuana? It would seem to me like you should go to a six-year extension. Isn't there a cost and a time expense there that may not be necessary?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes and no. I believe it would have been 5 years without the marijuana. The House Bill 123, the Marijuana Control Board, has an identical sunset date, and we would expect to be evaluating our activities around that licensing sooner rather than later. So I think this first time around, if the Marijuana Board bill does not pass and the ABC is left to regulate marijuana, it's probably a good idea for the auditors to visit us sooner, because we would have taken on that new task without the fiscal note associated with the marijuana regulation, which would be very difficult, and we would want them to see how we're doing. And if we do get the marijuana board bill, we'll be going through the process. It keeps the same staff and agency serving that second board, so we'll be going through the process anyway. So I think for this date, June of 2018, it's fine, although I agree with you in theory that them coming around very often does represent a cost to the agency.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 116, version 29LS0596/alpha from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection? Okay, seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork.
and Commerce Committee. Next, we have House Bill 178. This is a bill introduced by Representative Kurt Olson, and welcome his staff, Conrad Jackson. The intent is to hear the bill, take the members' questions, take public testimony, close public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee. With that, welcome Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The bill before you today, House Bill 178, grants a five-month extension to the time constraints set for the creation and implementation of a new fee schedule for workers' compensation medical services. The bill, as I kind of mentioned when we were off the record, could be likened to a five-month board extension without an audit and without a fiscal note. As some history, last year's House Bill 316 tasked the Medical Services Review Committee with creating a fee schedule based on Medicaid rates and then setting a multiplier for the various services. Once the conversion factor was set, it would need to be approved by the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and the Workers' Compensation Board, and obviously regulations would be drafted and implemented. Under current statute, all this work must be completed by July 1 of this year. The MSRC has met a number of times and is very close to completing their work, but they need just a touch more time. The department has requested the extension, and this five-month extension is anticipated to give them more than adequate time to complete all their work. As I said, the bill carries a zero fiscal note because the work was anticipated during the consideration and the creation of the fiscal note for House Bill 316 last year. Once the new fee schedule is in place, it is anticipated that we will see a lowering of the medical or the workers' compensation rates. And Madam Chairman and members, we have the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation here, Mike Monagle, to give you some more details on what the MSRC has done since the bill was passed last year, and just a little more details on just how close they are and the value of this five-month extension. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Mr. Monagle to come before the committee.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director for the Division of Workers' Compensation, and I chair the Medical Services Review Committee for the Commissioner.
Do you have any testimony you'd like to provide? Or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the House Bill 316 passed last summer. At that time, the Medical Services Review Committee had not met since 2009, so we had a couple positions on the committee we had to fill. That took a little bit of time. We had to go out and hire a contractor to assist the committee in developing fee schedules. We had to go through the state's competitive bid process. That took a little bit of time. We had to go out to bid to get the data that we needed to look at. And that took some time, and then we had some non-disclosure agreements to work our way through. So we got the contracts, we got the data, and we really in earnest started our discussions about November. We had been meeting monthly since July 2014. We've had 10 meetings to date. We've got all the conversion factor decided except one. We have a meeting next Monday, the 20th, in Anchorage. I expect that we will finish up that recommendation at that meeting. The process is then for us to make those recommendations to the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. I would expect that she would take public comment for a period of time. I'm hopeful then that we get referred to the Workers' Compensation Board, which we would probably hold a meeting in June. And then the board would have to go out through the normal public process for regulation adoption. So it would be virtually impossible to meet the July 1 deadline and have those regulations out there. If we have the June meeting and follow up with a July meeting or early August for final adoption, we should be able to get the regulations over to Lieutenant Governor's office by the end of summer. That will give medical providers and the insurance companies and employers 2 to 3 months to program their systems with the new fee schedules.
Any questions from committee members? My only question is, you had mentioned the Medical Services Review Committee hadn't met prior to that being sort of revved up again in 2014. They hadn't met since 2009. Is there a reason for that? Or?
Madam Chair, I think that the primary reason, they met extensively from 2006. They were formed in 2005. And issued some final reports in 2009, and none of their recommendations were acted on. And I think the committee just, quite honestly, did not feel empowered, or in essence didn't see the need to meet if their recommendations were going to go unheeded or no actions taken. So that I think it was a combination of the committee's will and the department. I think House Bill 316 gave them work to do, and so they have been spun back up, as you say, and have been meeting regularly since. And House Bill 316 also tasks the committee to evaluate these fee schedules on an annual basis. So I think there is going to be a need for the committee to continue to meet on a regular basis to do that body of work.
No questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify on House Bill 178? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone online at any of the LIOs who'd like to testify? Okay, not at this time. Public testimony is now closed. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 178, version 29, LS0813/HELO from the committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. And then we'll take a brief at ease. Committee is called back to order. Next on our agenda is House Bill 46, introduced by Representative Sadler. It's the Workforce Investment Board veteran member. The intent is to hear the bill, take members' questions, take public testimony, close it, and then look to the will of the committee. So with that, welcome, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Pleasure to be here, and a pleasure to acknowledge you as such. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 13. Pleasure to present this bill to the members of the committee. HB 46, I believe, will improve the Alaska Workforce Investment Board's ability to improve the employment prospects for an important segment of our population in my district. It does so by adding a seat specifically to represent veterans. The Workforce Investment Board, known as the AWIB, is a 26-member board charged with helping unemployed Alaskans find jobs and helping employed Alaskans find better jobs. Members represent business, industry, education, organized labor, state government, community-based organizations, and the public. However, there is no current representation specifically for veterans, who represent a significant and growing segment of our state's population. We have currently about 73,000 veterans in Alaska, and they're busy making more. And, of course, Alaska has the highest per capita population of veterans in the nation, and District 13 has the highest in Alaska, I'm proud to say. Each month, about 320 new veterans are coined as service members separate from service at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, from Allison Air Force Base, or from Fort Wainwright in the interior. And while polls indicate that 80% of these veterans would love to stay in Alaska, only about 20% do, and their inability to find a good job plays an important role in their decision to leave, and an important role in Alaska's loss of these well-qualified, highly trained, civic-minded people. I think that having a veteran's seat on the AWIB will help the board develop workforce policies to meet this group's unique needs, just as we do for natives, for developmentally disabled folks, and for community service organization folks. It will help provide a pool of well-trained employees for Alaska employers. It will help veterans transition out of uniform service, close any skills gap they might have, and remain in Alaska as productive working citizens. And I would add that it does this at no cost to the state. We have veterans ready and willing to volunteer their time and services. And I would appreciate your support for this bill and would be glad to entertain any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in reading the sponsor statement, I just want to clarify, we're not talking about simply a representative of veterans. We're talking about a veteran. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there will be a representative of veterans, and, you know, it would have to It would be a veteran, yeah. Who, and no one's better qualified to represent a veteran than a veteran.
You're here.
And for the record, I'm not. But
Representative Sadler, is there any opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, I've heard no opposition to it. I'd like to think that there's pretty good solid support for it. And I would note that this was actually brought to me by more than one veteran. There's several organizations that advocate for veterans' employment informally, and there's many veterans' advocacies. But the thought was that this is a specific way to influence statewide policy to try and help veterans get jobs in the state of Alaska.
Do you know the unemployment rate for veterans in Alaska?
You know, good question, Madam Chair. That's someplace deep in my packet. But I have to say the short answer is no, but I think about 6.7 is what I seem to recall.
Thank you.
And there are disparate levels, different cohorts of veterans. Those who were in the first Gulf War have different levels than those in Gulf II and the Global War on Terror and the Vietnam era and so forth.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just could you clarify the meaning given to the word veteran?
Thank you. Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, that the veteran in this legislation uses the definition, which means someone who has served honorably and gotten an honorable discharge in the armed forces, including the reserves, the National Guard, the Territorial Guard, Alaska Territorial Guard, the Alaska Naval Militia, and again, received honorable discharge.
Thank you. Not a veteran of the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. And online we have Greg Cashin with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mr. Cashin, would you like to provide comments on this bill?
Madam Chair, I don't really have any comments per se. We have been following this as it's related to the Workforce Investment Board. The department does provide quite a few training programs specifically for veterans. I think we support veterans in this state. As Representative Sadler mentioned, there's over 70,000 veterans in the state. So other than that, it would replace one of the private sector seats on the board currently on the AWIB. So that, just FYI, that would essentially require us to remove one of the private sector seats and put in the veteran seat.
Thank you. And it's my understanding there are 5 private sector seats currently on the board?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. There are 5 currently.
Thank you. And does the administration support the bill?
We don't have any real preference either way.
Thank you. Senator Giesel?
So, Mr. Cashin, would the replacement of one of the public members with a veteran member take place at a time of attrition, that is, when one of the public members was terming out, so to speak, or would it be an abrupt preemption of a term?
Through the Chair, Senator Giesel, I believe it would be through attrition, as you mentioned. There's 3 private sector seats with terms that expire October 13th, 2015, this year. So it would be one of those 3 seats, I believe so.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Okay, brief at ease. Committee's called back to order. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, the currently 5, and we hope 4 public seats, are designed specifically to ensure that there is a majority of private sector members on the board. It's not necessary that they all be appointed. In fact, if all the obligatory seats are filled, there does retain a majority of private sector people there. That's, they can add a few more weeks at the end of the teeter-totter to make sure.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Stevens.
Just a comment. Very easily, one of those private sector members could also be a veteran.
Through the Chair, that's correct. Or it could be Alaska Native, or it could have experience in education, or any number of things, but specifically it would be to represent a veteran's interest.
Sure. Okay.
I'd like to now open public testimony on this bill. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify on House Bill 46? Is there anyone online at any of the LIOs who would like to testify? Seeing no one, public testimony is closed. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 46, version 29, LS0282/alpha, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill moves from committee and we'll take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Next on the agenda is House Bill 41, introduced by Representative Kathy Tilton. Welcome. And it's the intent to hear the bill, take members' questions, open public testimony, and close public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further consideration. So with that, welcome, Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Tilton, representing House District 12. HB 41 seeks to reestablish the sport guide, fishing guide, and operator's license, which sunsetted on December 31st, 2014. This licensure was originally adopted by the legislature in 2004 and implemented by the Department of Fish and Game in 2005. The guide and operation license helps to mitigate the unmanaged growth of the charter fishing sector while ensuring the basic level of professionalism certification for individuals who serve in the guided recreational fishing public. In reestablishing HB 41, we have amended the existing fee structure, making the program revenue neutral to a revenue positive. The legislation itself is not meant to single out any type of or sector of the fishing industry. As we all know, there's lots of competition and discussion in the different sectors of fishing. It is simply to continue this program, which was already in effect. And I know that the legislature is looking at other fees in all different areas of fishing and hunting and bringing those into adjustment for appropriate finances to coincide with our state's fiscal position. So HB 41 just reestablishes the licenses that have benefited the guided sports fishing industry and the general public and increases the revenue necessary to establish and maintain the electronic logbook program that assists the state and our recreational anglers with critical management decisions while working on the necessary federal agencies.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
And how much does this increase fees by?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, the increase would be a double in the increase in the fees. In the original bill, we had done a stepped-up increase, which would increase them by $50 a year for 3 years. Going through House Finance and looking at the fiscal note to at the stepped-up position, they would not be in a revenue-positive position until the third year. Going through House Finance, we just went and just doubled the fees, and that would make them in a revenue and all slightly positive position right away.
Thank you. Is there any
opposition to the bill so far, and then could you mention on the record who support, who's on record supporting it, the bill with letters?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chairman. There is the CEO who, I don't know the actual, let me, I'm going to have my aide, Heath Hilliard, answer that for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Heath Hilliard, staff to Representative Tilton. To respond to your question directly, we had one individual in House Finance who testified. It was more of a qualified amended rather than opposition to the bill. There were a number of issues relating to sport fishing that he brought up, but a number of those issues were issues that this body, not just this committee, that the legislature as a whole can't deal with. They pertain to federal fisheries management that the North Council is responsible for, that the legislature just can't deal with. There was a guide from the Mat-Su area, I believe his name is Andy Couch, who wrote a letter yesterday, I believe it was, in opposition to the bill. We didn't have it really an opportunity to review it because it wasn't sent to the two co-prime sponsors, so we haven't had a chance to really delve into that in any detail, but I believe you have, I think it's Sure Strike Charters, or there are a couple of different charter operators from Juneau who have submitted letters of support. You have a letter of support from the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, and Mr. McKinster, who represents them, is here today and can provide testimony. And I believe, I don't know if he's got a letter in there, but I know he did testify in House Finance. Andy Mesereau, who is the governor's nominee for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, has also testified in favor of this bill. He's been a charter operator in Alaska for 25 years. So generally speaking, the charter industry is generally supportive. I do know that there's a sort of a difference of opinion. I don't know if that's the right way to put it. I do know that there's much more urgency on the part of the saltwater charter guides than the freshwater. And we made House on the floor yesterday made several amendments that was trying to be somewhat responsive to concerns that were brought to us by some of the freshwater guides. So I'd be happy to answer any further questions, but that's what I know in terms of pro and con.
Thank you, and I do see a letter from the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization. Could you run through the amendments that occurred on the House floor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. You should have an explanation of changes. Section 4, pages 3, lines 10 through 19, the bill was amended on the floor to remove the requirement in state statute that a person holding a sport fishing guide or operator's license must also have a Coast Guard license. The reason that was done is the Coast Guard determines where the navigable waters are, and so a vast majority of the guides will be required to have a Coast Guard license anyway. We did that in recognition, again, of some of the freshwater guides in interior Alaska, where some of the waters have not been determined to be navigable waters, and so it was an undue burden for them. So we removed that just simply so that the Coast Guard will determine who needs a license and who doesn't. The second one was we changed the sunset date from 10 years to 5. Some of the members in the other body thought that 10 was too excessive, and quite honestly, in drafting the bill, it was sort of an arbitrary number. And that was section 11, page 10, lines 9, for that second change of the sunset date.
And could you review what the electronic logbook program is? I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I just would like for the committee for you to review that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We also do have Mr. Brookover from the department online, and we also have Mr. Mulligan from the department who can answer some questions, but I can address that in brief. I know that the department has been discussing the establishment of an electronic logbook for a number of years. The electronic logbook would aid in the data collection and analysis in both in terms of the ability to collect more data and the ability to analyze it in real time. The logbook information currently, the hard logbook, I mean, that information gathered during the fishing season is used to inform both the state and federal fisheries managers in terms of allocation decisions. And so the revenue stream associated with this increase would actually help support the establishment and maintenance of an electronic logbook. My understanding, and again, the department's here, my understanding is the department is intending to do a beta test in the Kenai River area this summer with the intention of, in the next year or two, trying to roll it out on a statewide basis, but they need to do a beta test first. But again, the department's here, so.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
I think I heard it, but I'm not sure. The sunset date is what now?
Senator, through the chair, it's 2021.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
At this point, I think I'd like to invite Mr. Mulligan up, and Mr. Brookover is also online with the Fish and Game for questions related to the bill. Welcome.
Hi. Hello, Senator Costello. Through the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game, and we're happy to answer any questions. I may refer to Acting Director Brookover for details at a point in time if I don't have the answers that you need.
Sure. Any questions for the department? I am interested in knowing more about the electronic logbook program and when that would be up and running and what the expected cost would be and just how that would operate.
Through the chair, Senator Costello. Heath just said, we're looking at getting a beta test on the Kenai. And that, so far, the infrastructure to get that rolling and put into place is a part of an overall electronic modernization CIP project that we got in through the budget a couple of years ago. And so it's part of a larger picture. I'm not sure about the exact numbers. I can, we'll refer to Mr. Brookover after I get done. And then depending on how the beta test goes, we could roll out and expand it within a year, or it could take a couple more years to do so, just depending on how the bugs work in, I would say, real life. I mean, because you're going to have guides out in field conditions or, you know, out in their lodges working on these, and so there could be unforeseen circumstances that lead us to delay it. But we're going to try to get that going as soon as possible, knowing that it's been asked for from the guiding industry for some time, and we now have the capability through that CIP to do so.
And does the department have a position on the bill?
We are supportive of getting the sport fish guide licensing and logbook program back into place.
Okay. Mr. Brookover, would you like to provide testimony on the bill?
Through the chair, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Tom Brookover, Acting Director, Division of Sport Fish. And I would echo what Mr. Mulligan said with respect to the electronic logbook program. It is a continuing element of our license modernization effort. Just about a month or maybe a little bit more ago, we the department launched the new online licensing store. And with that, there's now a capability for folks to purchase and then print out their license at home, their sport fishing license at home, and also purchase more than one family member's license at a time, or more than one license at a time, sort of a one-stop shop. Our division is looking at two elements furthering that initiative this summer, one of which is to enable personal use permitting and reporting capabilities for the Cook Inlet and Chitna personal use fisheries. Our aim is to have that functionality up this summer so that people will be able to obtain permits and report their harvest information for those fisheries. And then the second element is, as Mr. Mulligan mentioned, a pilot program on the Kenai for an electronic charter logbook program. We're looking at, a more full implementation over the next year or two. This would be our test. Right now we're developing a database and we are contracting out for a platform that will be usable for the entering the information and managing the information through the Charter Logbook Program. We anticipate a meeting with the guides on the Kenai next month to get that up and running this summer. It'll be a relatively small pilot program, but the main purpose is to make a system work and test the functionality this season on the Kenai with the idea of expanding it next year. So again, like Mr. Mulligan, we're in support of the bill, and I think that's what I have at this point.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to open public testimony for this bill, and we will be adjourning the committee at 3. We have two individuals who are signed up online, and if there's anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify, Okay, seeing no one here. Mr. Rohr from Kodiak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two concerns that I want to bring your attention to. One is in the bill. The other is not in the bill. First
Mr.
of all,
Rohr, do you mind identifying yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Dick Rohr in Kodiak. I've been a big game guide since the early 70s, a sportfish guide since the early 80s. So if you could look under the penalty section on page 5, beginning line 22 through line 30. This is provision for strict liability penalties that potentially can be extremely severe. Let me read line 22 under C. A person who knowingly violates AS 16402 71E, that's the section that says I have to carry a license in my pocket and have identification, and then who knowingly fails to comply with a requirement for timely submission of reports required. That's my logbook reports that have to be turned in every week. For first offense, a strict liability violation. For a second offense in a 3-year period, a Class B misdemeanor. And in addition to that, a court could revoke my sport fish guiding license. I would just admit that these penalties are potentially way too severe for two cases of where my logbook page was not received by Fish and Game in a timely manner. I give you a suggestion to possibly fix that if we could insert the word intentionally on line 22, either in place of knowingly or following knowingly. So it would read, I would knowingly and intentionally fail to meet the deadline. If you're not familiar with the timing of when we're required to have logbooks into Fish and Game, essentially the week runs Monday to Sunday, and any activity on Sunday I would have the following Monday to have that information submitted to Fish and Game. Otherwise, I'm in violation under this statute and with a pretty severe penalty if that happens twice. Most of the logbook and most of this discussion relates to charter boat operators who are in and out of town every day. That's not the case for those of us who operate remotely, and especially for those guides who are in interior areas and or big game guides who have a client who wants to do some incidental fishing. For example, this week, we're in the midst of our bear hunting season in Kodiak. I have my logbooks for sport fishing. I fly a client to camp on the 18th. That's in a couple of days. Any fishing, but he doesn't return to Kodiak until May 2nd. It's a $1,000 airplane charter to get him to camp. So any fishing he did on the 18th or the 19th of April, those logbooks would be required to be in by April 27th, and I don't have an airplane till May the 2nd. Otherwise, I have to charter an airplane for $1,000 to go pick up that logbook. So the timing is really difficult in these situations. Then I'll just briefly state that in legislation that we looked at several years ago, relating to the sportfish guiding industry, we had included an exemption clause provision for big game guides who had clients who did incidental sport fishing while on a contracted big game hunt, and they would be exempt from it. So you would, the fishing is purely incidental. They might want to catch a dolly varden, a lake trout, a silver salmon to eat, and it's just extremely difficult for them to meet the logbook timing requirements, and I think it's appropriate for those businesses to have an incidental exemption. So with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Rohr. The time is up for this committee. I will keep public testimony open. Our next meeting will be Thursday, April 16th at 1:30, and the agenda will be announced tomorrow. With that, the meeting is adjourned.